You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 3, Kidnapping, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 1, Zephyr Way. Zephyr Way is a remarkable road. It spans the breadth of the continent from east to west, meeting oceans at either end. Every step along its length reveals another wonder. Forests that span to the horizon, canyons carved deep by raging rivers, placid lakes, towering waterfalls, and snow-capped mountains. Not only is it a tour of breathtaking beauty, but Zephyr Way dodges every hill and valley in its course across the continent. In most places, it's so flat that rain cannot sort out which way to flow, leaving it wandering in confused circles on the smooth granite surface until it freezes or evaporates away. Zephyr Way is so straight that on a clear day, from its highest point among the great Rocky Mountain range, one can see the entire length of it stretching out to either side like arrows on a compass. That combination of features may seem impossible to a rational mind, but Zephyr Way has no particular interest in abiding by the sensibilities of mere humans. It is a fairy road, a pathway that traces lines where the veil between the fairy realm and the bland lands thins. Like its cousin, Detritus Lane, which it crosses several times but never intersects, a single step along it can cross miles traveled by any other avenue. Also, like Detritus Lane, it is riddled with holes. The veil is so thin along the way that there are small tears, places that a person with enough connection to magic can pass through, crossing from the mundane world to the fairy realm. An unwary individual could wander through the wrong hedge, explore the wrong cave, or crawl through the wrong hollow in the Blandlands and find themselves stumbling onto Zephyr Way with no notion of what had happened or how to get back. This feature was causing Kuro some degree of trouble. Kuro wasn't lost on the wrong side of the veil. Quite the opposite. Kuro was traveling Zephyr Way intentionally. He had slipped away from the Bytown Royal Orphanage, walked down the long, uneven driveway to the way, and was enjoying the cool quiet of a nighttime stroll along the road with his raccoon, Autolycus. Breaking out had become a nightly habit, a way to escape the orphanage, where he spent his days within its high walls, stewing in heat and boredom. The slow and gentle process of picking the locks on the heavy steel door of the orphanage was a soothing and satisfying ritual. It helped him relax and prepare to sleep, gave him something meaningful to do with his restless hands, and made him briefly feel like less of an unremitting failure. Kuro was really only good at three things: running away, hiding, and taking things that did not belong to him. None of these was held in high regard in wizarding society, which preferred academic acumen, magical talent, and having parents. Kuro was poor at all of those, and remarkably bad at the last one, even among those at the orphanage. Some, like the Lamorack sisters, Bella and Azalea, had excellent parents of noble lineage who had tragically passed away. Others, like Airy Vanderbosch, did not know their parentage, having been abandoned or having strayed in from the Blandlands. Kuro, however, simply did not have any parents. He was the result of an almost successful experiment to blend Luton and Wizard into a single creature. His very existence was a crime. His livelihood until his capture 2 years prior, even more so, as he had pickpocketed and burgled for survival. Kuro was a convict, of which the walls of the orphanage and the silver bracelet around his wrist were a constant reminder. His nightly breakouts were a small exercise in freedom, a way to prove to himself that his captivity was at least partly voluntary, and he had some choices left in the direction of his life. The absolute majesty of the scenery along Zephyr Way didn't hurt either. Just a few minutes east of where the orphanage driveway met the road was a view of a great limestone cliff over which a waterfall poured. A short stroll later was a broad pond filled with croaking frogs and lit by countless glowbugs dancing among the reeds. It was hard to feel like too much of a captive when surrounded by so much glorious space. This night, however, was complicated by the unwelcome presence of another person on the road. It was a human kind of person, one he'd never met, and he would have preferred for that to continue. Kuro's natural response to encountering someone on Zephyr Way was to hide. To be entirely honest, that was his natural response to encountering another person anywhere, but on the way in particular. He wasn't supposed to be there. Neither, for that matter, was this person. They wore jeans, sneakers, and a t-shirt with an image of a smiling spined monster painted on it in a green so vibrant that it was painful to look at directly. It was the kind of color that could be tolerated only in the muted world of the Blandlands. They were clearly astray who had stumbled across a gap in the veil and gotten stuck in the fairy realm. Now they were sitting in the middle of Zephyr Way, crying. Sobbing, actually. It was the sort of pathetic, choking whimper that remains after someone has already bawled out every tear they had. A final expression of upset before exhaustion completely takes over. Kuro didn't typically have much sympathy for crying, mostly because he was unfamiliar with the practice. It had been denied to him, trained out before he was old enough to remember. He didn't understand its purpose. It was incapacitating and noisy. Crying drew attention, dulled the senses, and clouded the mind, and most people seemed to do it at times when they needed to be at their sharpest, when frightened or injured. Kuro could not hide if he was whimpering, nor run if he couldn't see through his tears. It was an exceptionally poor idea to cry while alone in the wilderness around Zephyr Way. There were wolves of both the dire and were variety in the woods, giant serpents in the waters, and vicious cave bears in the hills. Sitting still and shouting was as good as ringing a dinner bell. In this case, though, Kuro could forgive the ill-advised sniveling. A stray wouldn't know any better. This stray, in particular, couldn't possibly know the danger, because they couldn't be any older than 3. Kuro looked to his small, furry traveling companion for some counsel, but Autolycus avoided Kuro's eyes. The raccoon fidgeted with his tiny, hand-like paws and shifted his gaze about, already feeling guilty for considering abandoning the lost child to the wilderness. Autolycus wasn't a real raccoon. He was Kuro's familiar, a conjured creature, an extension of Kuro, given form and a facsimile of life through magic. He was also a pest, a coward, and a thief, rarely where he should be and too curious for his own good. Which is to say, he was a painfully good reflection of his creator. Most wizards would merely unsummon a troublesome familiar, but Autolycus was stuck in physical form. He'd been left out too long and had started having ideas of his own, including the notion that he'd like to keep existing. He resisted the magic used to reabsorb him into Kuro's mind and had developed too much of a personality of his own for Kuro to feel good about popping him. Seeing his own feelings painted across his familiar, Kuro felt twice as guilty for thinking of leaving the stray child. He looked up and down the road for some sign of a traveler. In the daytime, some car, sled, or carriage would be passing every few minutes, but at night, it might take hours. A distant howl made Kuro doubt they had that long. He and Autolycus started searching nearby bushes and ditches for gateways back to the Blandlands. The few they did find didn't have the panicked parents Kuro had hoped for. They were just portals to vast, empty expanses of forest. He could push the child through, but being lost and alone in a Blandlands forest was only slightly better than in the fairy realm. Depending how far the child had wandered up Zephyr Way, they could be hundreds of miles from their Blandlands home. Kuro muttered his discontent under his breath and accepted that he was going to have to help the child directly. "Could you stop crying, please?" Kuro asked as his means of introduction. The request had the opposite of the desired effect. The child, recognizing that someone was available to hear their wails, began sobbing with renewed vigor.
Don't do that, pleaded Kuro. Something will definitely come and eat you.
The child was not moved by the logic of that argument, and, if anything, cried louder. Autolycus shook his head dismissively at Kuro's inability to comfort the child.
Oh, I'd like to see you do any better, replied Kuro to the silent criticism.
To Kuro's surprise, Autolycus took up the challenge, boldly walking up to the child. As he neared, though, his true nature shone through, and his confident steps slowed to a hesitant shuffle. He managed to rally enough courage to touch the crying toddler on the shoulder with his paw in something approaching a comforting pat. The effect was immediate, but not at all what he had wished. The child latched onto the raccoon, throwing their arms around his chest and squeezing him like a stuffed animal.
While this provided solace for the child, it had quite the opposite effect on Autolycus, who struggled to find a way to escape that did not involve maiming his captor. As the lost child held firm, crushing the air from the raccoon, Autolycus reached out feebly and looked to his creator with pleading eyes for rescue. Kuro rolled his eyes in response. The raccoon couldn't suffocate. It didn't need to breathe. It wasn't even alive. Kuro instead took advantage of the brief calm to come up with a plan. He wished Marie were there. She was the oldest of several brothers and sisters and probably knew how to deal with younger children. Sadly, she was completely out of reach, spending her summer at home with those same siblings out in the Blandlands. Charlie would have been good to have around as well. She might not know much about human children, but she was wonderful with baby animals on her farm. If she could soothe a teething hydra, she could probably handle a grumpy toddler who only had a single head to comfort. She even lived on Zephyr Way, but at the completely wrong end of it. Even by truck, it would take hours to reach her farm. Arthur was vastly closer. Kuro could run to Bytown in less than an hour if needed. That was still too far, and came with a host of other complications. The first being that Arthur was no better at dealing with humans than Kuro, and the second that Arthur's adoptive father was a knight commander in the Royal Guard who had previously arrested Kuro. He had no interest in explaining to Sir Talon Dubois why he was wandering Zephyr Way after dark. No, Kuro was alone. This was his problem. Based on the chorus of wolves in the hills, it would soon become a mortal one. He took a deep, slow breath and tried to channel the energy of the good people he'd known, the unflappable patience of his first spellcraft teacher, Ms. Crawley, the compassion of Mr. Schumacher, who had gifted him his sneakers, the optimism of his caseworker, Sabine, and the gentle kindness of the woman who had been his involuntary nanny, Helena.
"Hi, I'm Kuro. What's your name?"
Kuro asked, taking a knee in front of the lost child and attempting to affect a smile that was kind and undemanding. The kid's response was too muffled by being issued through sniffles into Autolycus's fur to understand.
"It's nice to meet you," Kuro said as genuinely as he could. "Are you lost?"
A pained look from Autolycus indicated that the child was squeezing him even harder as they mumbled a series of incoherent nonsense into his pelt. Through the gibberish was a single intelligible word.
"Bobby, how about we find your mommy together?"
Kuro reached out a hand in what he hoped was a non-threatening way, and the child took it, firmly grasping two of Kuro's outstretched fingers. With his free hand, Kuro dug a piece of chalk out of his book bag, which he never left his room without, and marked the spot on the road where he had found the child. It would be much easier to find where they had come from if he left a sign as to where they had been found. Kuro led the kid up Zephyr Way towards the orphanage. There was no better place for misplaced children. The matron, Miss Bridget, would know what to do. They walked hand in hand, Kuro on one side leading them forward, Autolycus on the other being dragged slightly behind, both held firm in the vice-like grip of the lost child. The slow pace of a three-year-old provided Kuro time to scheme. He could pick the locks to the outer door of the orphanage and slip inside as he did most nights. So long as he could keep the child relatively quiet until they reached the central manor, he could abandon them there and sneak back to his own little room in the outlying cabins. The child would be safe until they were inevitably found by Miss Bridget or one of the orphans. All Kuro needed was the tiniest bit of good fortune. Good fortune, though, was among the many things of which Kuro had less than most. No sooner had Kuro crafted his plan when it was dashed by a bog sloth slumping through a stand of reeds out onto the road. The odd proportions of the creature made it look more like one of the chalk drawings by the younger children at the orphanage than a naturally grown animal. A pear-shaped body with stumpy hind legs and paddle-like feet, topped with a long, blocky head, which seemed to be attached the wrong way around, so that there was more space for nostrils than brain. The little eyes looked like they were included as an afterthought, far too small for the head, and unable to see around the oversized nose. It had arms so long that when it stood up on its hind legs, they hung almost to the ground, and two curved claws on each hand made up the rest of that distance. The thing that stood out most about the bog sloth, however, was it being entirely the wrong size. The sloth's odd shape would have been easier to accept if it had been smaller than a truck.
The massive beast thudded its way onto the road, blocking the way forward. Kuro stopped and stood dead still, hoping the dark night and the bog sloth's poor eyesight would be enough to keep them hidden, or at least beneath notice, as he racked his brain for everything he knew about these animals. Charlie had told him a lot about them, but she told him a lot about a lot of things, and it was difficult to keep it all organized. It didn't help that she rarely distinguished which parts were facts, things she'd read in a story, or flights of fancy. The first thing he could recall was that these sloths had an excellent sense of smell. Given the size of the nose and the way it stood on its haunches sniffing the air, Kuro could have guessed that himself. The next was that they were herbivores, eating only lily pads and cattails. A small stroke of fortune, meaning it was unlikely to view the collection of three much smaller creatures on the road as snacks. The final piece of information Kuro could remember, which Charlie lamented as the reason they could not keep one on her farm, was that bog sloths were extremely, violently territorial and would use those long claws to dismantle anything foolish enough to wander too close. Kuro asked the wind for aid. Controlling the wind was one of the very few magics that Kuro could reliably perform, although he didn't know why or how that was true. The only explanation he'd ever received was from a talking coyote, who had told him that he was the beloved of the West Wind and that she came to his aid when called because of her affection for him. That seemed like nonsense, but even so, he'd begun treating the wind with more consideration, letting her visit him on her own schedule and asking for help only when he really needed it. At Kuro's silent plea, the evening breeze shifted directions to keep them downwind from the monster. This kept the sloth from being able to smell them, but provided them with the opportunity to smell it. The moss and mud caking its tattered fur was ripe with the earthy scents of decay. Kuro struggled not to gag. Silence and stillness were his best chance at surviving. He just had to wait for the sloth to move on without earning its notice. This, however, was difficult to explain to the toddler attached to his right hand. As the sloth plodded past them along the road, oblivious to their presence, the child chose that moment to voice their thoughts on the situation. "Moo cow," they observed, releasing Kuro's hand to point, just in case Kuro was uncertain which enormous nearby animal they were talking about. Startled to find something so close that it could not smell and hadn't heard, the sloth let out a bellow. The night was shattered by a cry something like a foghorn going through puberty, and the air filled with the stench of its fetid breath. They were offered the chance for a good look into the wide maw filled with dozens of grinding molars and a writhing purple tongue. Kuro rejected that opportunity in favor of running away. He unslung his book bag and pushed it over the child at his side, scooping them and Autolycus up in one swift motion. The child released a cry of surprise and confusion upon finding themselves in a small office, complete with drawers, shelves, and a desk. Kuro tried not to advertise the unusual nature of his bag, but this was an emergency, and he was pretty sure the child wouldn't be able to explain it if asked. Those two safely stowed, Kuro bolted up the road. He hoped that the sloth would either live up to its name and be easy to outrun, or be satisfied with having frightened the invaders away. To his dismay, it was neither. It gave chase in an uneven, lumbering gallop, with its back legs working furiously to keep up with the front. Kuro did not need to look back to judge the distance as the clacking of the claws on the granite road and the noise like asthmatic bagpipes issuing forth from the creature's nose gave a clear indication that it was far too close for comfort, and Kuro was barely outpacing it. Kuro called for the West Wind's aid for the first time that summer, and she answered with vigor. The wind that had been his close ally and protector for most of his life, helping him climb higher, jump farther, and run faster, swirled and rushed at him from behind. His already unkempt hair blew into his face, and his loose shirt and threadbare jeans flapped furiously. But something was terribly wrong. He felt the force on his back, but it did nothing to speed his run. A rainbow glimmer on his right wrist caught his eye. The intricate runes carved into the delicate silver bangle hanging there were shining brightly. That bracelet had been forced on him by Talon Dubois to prevent Kuro from performing a kind of magic that he wasn't even able to do. Among other things, it keeps Luton from blinking place to place, he had said. What other things it did hadn't been elaborated on. It seemed one of those things was preventing Kuro from escaping giant angry beasts or rescuing lost children. Typical. He quietly hoped that he would live long enough to get properly upset about it. He pushed all the energy he had into making his frustratingly short legs do the work that the wind couldn't. The driveway for the orphanage neared, and the wind changed direction sharply to blast Kuro sideways, but it continued to have no impact on his velocity. Being so used to relying on the help of the wind, Kuro failed to turn the corner at all, instead tripping on his own feet and tumbling farther along the road. The bog sloth was even less ready for the sudden turn, and its momentum carried it straight into Kuro. It slammed headlong into him, then bounced off as though it had hit a solid concrete wall instead of a boy a fraction of its size. Kuro felt like he'd just done a belly flop onto the pavement. The air had been knocked out of his lungs, and his attempts to get it back in alerted him to several broken ribs. The bog sloth rolled and groaned as it tried to untangle its arms and shake the effects of the impact from its tiny brain. Self-preservation beat out the need to breathe or count wounds. Kuro stumbled up the long driveway of weeds and split pavement to the orphanage. Still lacking a voice to shout and his hands too shaky from exhaustion to pick the locks himself, he banged on the rusty iron door. The sloth regained most of its senses and all of its anger. It stomped drunkenly up the driveway toward the orphanage, huffing and grunting its threats of revenge at the tiny thing that had invaded its territory and caused it pain. Kuro stopped his pounding and fell silent as the sloth approached, becoming a statue in the dark, invisible again to the monster. The wind, while unable to move Kuro, still did its best to aid him, keeping him downwind to mask his scent. The beast paused mere yards away as it huffed the air, and its little ears twitched, trying to locate some sign of Kuro. He held his breath. It was a struggle after such a hard run and with broken ribs screaming their opposition, but he held it anyway. Seconds ticked by, and the beast's fury began to subside. With a huff, it gave up the search and plodded back down the driveway toward Zephyr Way. Until the sound of the door locks sliding open gave away Kuro's position, with renewed vigor, the bog sloth charged, roaring up the driveway. The wind tried to push Kuro up the concrete wall to safety, but the silver bracelet flickered with its delicate rainbow, and he remained in place. The sloth slowed so it could raise a massive claw. As it came down, the door squeaked open. Kuro fell backwards into the orphanage grounds, and a bolt of lightning split the night. The sloth shrieked its dismay and ran off into the woods. Kuro looked up to find the sneering, superior grins of the Lamorak sisters staring down at him. "Did you have a nice walk?" Azalea asked.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.